number SCWC29939, State v. Tierney, arguing for the petitioner Jack Schweigert, arguing for the respondent Brian Vincent, arguing for the merits.
Good morning, counsel. Mr. Schweigert, it's my understanding you're going to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal? Okay. And Mr. Vincent, we're going to give you a minute with warning with 5 minutes to go. Is that correct? If you would, please proceed, Mr. Schweigert.
May it please the court, Jack Schweigert on behalf of Mr. Tierney. I'm court appointed in this case. The case took off on a rather unusual twist in the sense that we have an individual smoking a marijuana joint in the middle of a populated area in downtown Honolulu, as if there was nobody around. That should have been some sign that there was something wrong with that individual. But if there was a doubt at his first hearing, when he's before the judge, he's asking the judge. He's saying to the judge, "You know, Judge, I'm sick. I need help. What can you do? I need some something." And the judge refuses him by basically referring him over to the public defenders. By the second hearing, a different judge sees his mannerisms in court, makes the decision right then, this person needs to be examined on a one panel. She does order a one panel. During the one panel, he doesn't cooperate. In the order that directs that he be examined, as well as under state law, there's a requirement. If you can't examine somebody because they refuse, as opposed to as a result of their disorder, that you're supposed to remark about that and explain that. And the buzzwords, the words that could be the linchpin would be the words, if possible, that's what you're supposed to do. At the next hearing, this judge had ordered a second examination, and the second examination, the same response was that the defendant basically did not cooperate, took the Fifth Amendment. During any of these proceedings, no one is telling this defendant, and you won't see it anywhere in the medical records, and you won't see it anywhere in the instructions or in the order of the court assigning the mental panel. You won't see anywhere in there mentioning that under the statute, anything you say in a mental examination can't be used against you. It's basically confidential information, and the idea is to get the truth out and not to worry about further prosecution. But none of that is said to this individual. Finally, on a final hearing, and this is a hearing that is really confusing. It's confusing not only from what's not asked. This is the hearing where, which we'll call the sanity hearing, and it will be combined with a hearing on a right to go with pro se. This individual wanted to go pro se, and up to this point in time, he'd been denied. So at this next hearing before a judge, we're not really sure of the judge. Very little questions are asked about his sanity, like, you know, when's the last time you went to a doctor? Have you been treated for psychology? Have you received any medical treatments for some kind of mental disorder? Basically, the only question that was asked of the defendant at this, quote, hearing for competency / hearing for the right to counsel, the only question that I can recall being asked was whether he felt better. And he said he did, and his response was as to why he felt better. He felt better because he had been detoxing, and he'd been detoxing because he'd been in jail for a couple of months by that point in time. But other than that, all of the questions during the hearing, there was supposed to be a dual hearing, one for competency and one for purposes of determining whether he should be able to go pro se. Only one question of many, many, many questions dealt with that issue. The defendant went on, was allowed at that very same hearing to defend himself, and at the following hearings, which I think took two, He was convicted, and he was convicted of its petty misdemeanor. It's petty misdemeanor of the possession of marijuana. We're looking at a 30-day jail time. We're looking at a possible fine of $1,000. In this particular case, Mr. Tierney received a fine of $5. The case that we believe, the defense believes, is critical is there's two cases. There's going to be just State versus just Janto, J-A-N-T-O, and I have the cites on both of those cases. State versus Janto is 92 Haw, page 19. And then the other case is State versus Castro, which is a more recent case. It's 93 Hawaii, 454. Both of those cases stand for the proposition that the whole purpose underlying 704, the intent, which we're always trying to find out what was the intent of the legislature. The intent of the legislature in drafting 704 was clearly to find whether a person was competent or not competent, but to base that determination, because none of us are psychologists, I assume, maybe I shouldn't presume that, but I don't know of any of you being psychologists. The purpose was in determining the competency of an individual, it was primarily, and I'll take this, Janto says it, so also does Castro, primarily a matter for the professional determination of the examiners appointed by the trial court. Because it's a medical decision. You've seen many times, like you can't even bring a malpractice case in this state without a medical expert. You can't go to the MCCP. You certainly can't file a lawsuit without a medical expert. Here we're talking about the fitness of an individual to stand trial.
Mr. Schweiger, if I could, you know, the statute, and you mentioned this, says that if possible, an opinion as to whether the unwillingness to cooperate with the exam was the result of physical or mental disease, disorder, or defect. In other words, the examiner should, if possible, in the report, state an opinion as to whether there was the mental disease, disorder, or defect played a role in the decision of the defendant not to cooperate. Is it your position, based on the report here, that it was, in fact, possible to do something more than what this examiner did, which is articulate the fact that the defendant had declined to cooperate on two occasions, articulate the fact that although he attempted to administer examinations, he wasn't able to do so, and then articulate the surrounding facts as the examiner understood them? Given all of those circumstances, why is it not reasonable to conclude that it was not possible for this examiner to express an opinion beyond the observations that he made?
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, I do believe it is the responsibility of the examiner. Take your first question. It is the responsibility of the examiner to identify whether he can or cannot form an opinion based on the information that he has so far, assuming at that point in time that the person he's examining walks away, takes the fifth, doesn't cooperate. I would also add to that the judge is supposed to base his decision by looking at experts. He's not supposed to base his decision based on his own impression of whether this guy's fit to proceed, because he's not a psychologist. He's not a psychiatrist. He's merely someone who knows all the laws there might be to know, but does he know whether a guy is sane or insane? That's another question. So the way I read the statute, it says, if possible, but the way the defense reads the word, if possible, if you don't make that possible, that they got to at least give an opinion one way or the other, the principles of Janto and the principles of Castro will become lost. Because the judge, after a short period of time, will say,
Dr. Gitter had said, I cannot state an opinion as to whether Mr. Tierney's unwillingness was the result of physical or mental disease, disorder, or defect? What if he had so stated?
Well, I have actually seen as many as four reports where there was four different orders to be examined and then to be examined again and then to be examined even a fourth time, because on each of those first three times they didn't cooperate. But we do have 416, which does say anything you say is confidential. And I believe it would be possible to have if a defendant wants a defense of not guilty by reason of insanity, he's generally going to cooperate. But if he's so crazy that he's not the kind that's willing to cooperate, there is ways to make him cooperate. Number one, let him know nothing will happen as a result of his cooperation.
If Dr. Gitter had said and repeatedly stated that it is not possible for me to state an opinion as to whether his unwillingness was a result of mental disease, disorder, or defect.
Well, I believe thank you, Justice McKenna. I believe the doctor really dropped the ball. It's not like these doctors go into the examination by just, I think the first thing I'll do is go out to OCCC and see the defendant. The first thing they do is they go to Courts and Corrections and they take a look at the record and file. And the second thing they go to is they go to the parole office. And this doctor did both of those things. And then they also take a look at the individual's medical record. Now, in this particular case, there was no psychological records for whatever reason to look at. But there were medical records, there were institutional file records, and there were also parole records. So there was enough of a source out there for the doctor to take a look at, to draw an opinion as to whether he could at least draw an opinion on whether the guy's sane or not sane, or fit to proceed or not fit to proceed. So he dropped the ball. Number two, it is his responsibility.
You've never seen a situation where a doctor repeatedly says, I'm not able to state an opinion as to whether or not his unwillingness or failure to refusal to cooperate is based on mental disease.
Hey, Judith, I've never had, in my years, not that there are that many, but in my years I've never had an individual not cooperate with a doctor.
The point is, the statute says it's in mandatory terms. If the examination cannot be conducted by reason of the unwillingness of the defendant to cooperate, then the doctor the examiner shall try to determine whether or not that unwillingness to cooperate is related to a mental disease, disorder, or defect.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
And the statute goes on to say, if possible, render an opinion as to whether or not it's a product of disease, disorder, or defect. So the statute itself is mandatory, right?
It's mandatory to the extent once he makes a determination, right? And I also think it's mandatory to the extent that if you think of the number of guys that are going to be going under mental examinations that come from India, that are going to be mentally unstable. Could be, I don't know if there's any average, there's 6,000 prisoners in a Hawaii jail. So I'm assuming a certain significant number of those are in there because they're mentally unstable.
So in this case, the doctor said nothing at all, totally silent as to whether or not he tried or attempted to follow this mandate. Then we don't know whether he attempted to even try. Because the statute says, if possible. But based on the report itself, we don't know if the doctor or the examiner even tried to determine that, because he doesn't say whether it was possible or not possible.
That's exactly right. And he doesn't say it not once, but he doesn't say it twice.
So is that the reason why you would want, or why the statute would seem to require that in the report the doctor say, well, I attempted to determine whether this unwillingness was a product of disease, disorder, or defect, but either I could or I could not, because it was just not possible for me to do that.
Well, I wish, had the doctor been forced to make such a decision, I mean, I happen to have now learned since I've been on this case, for the period of time that I've been on this case, I've been able to learn the personality of this individual. And this individual has had several, severe injuries during the history of his life. So I wouldn't have made the motion if I didn't have belief that there was a good faith basis behind the filing of such a motion. So when I filed, I thought the guy was crazy. I thought he was not cooperating with me. I thought he was not a help to me. I thought his understanding of the law was delusional. I thought that he was more hindrance than help. I really didn't have a good time going out.
Is it important for the court to know that the doctor attempted to determine that and what the result of the doctor's examination was?
Yes, yes.
Why?
Because the doctor's supposed to make, you start off with the doctor, if you take Jonto and you take Castro, the doctor is supposed to start off with a professional opinion, Your Honor. It's not supposed to be his opinion. He has the concern, he has the original concern that triggers the examination. And once he's made that determination, there shall be a report that's done. But when you read the history of 704 under, you know, the commentary to the Hawaii Revised Statutes, they have a commentary to 704 that is very illustrative. And it says basically the purpose, I mean, we want to find what's the purpose of the law, and the purpose of the law, when you go to subsection 5, which is where the main section is, it will say, is to get, you know, to identify the competency of this individual by professionals. So we're talking, this is a professional kind of a thing. Normally, whenever you deal with the brain, you're dealing with a professional kind of thing. It's not the kind of thing that a judge can do. So if a judge doesn't hear from a doctor in writing, number one, he's cut off the ability to have a professional take a look at the situation, because this professional is saying, I can't. Well, if he says, I can't, maybe other professionals, when they looked at those records, when they looked at that institutional file, when they looked at the, you know, the probation office records, maybe that expert could come up with a conclusion that the guy was sane or not sane, competent or not competent. So it denies the defense. It also defies the purpose of the rule, which is to not make it a judge decision, but to make it a professional opinion.
Well, the letter that this doctor wrote said, I'm unable to answer the questions regarding the defendant's fitness to proceed because of his refusal to participate. Is it not fairly subsumed within that he was also unable to determine whether his refusal to answer questions or participate was a product of
that? I wouldn't draw that conclusion.
So what do you think the doctor should have done in this case?
I think he just dropped the ball.
What should he have done?
He should have gone forward to identify whether he can answer questions. First of all, he should have explained 416 to the defendant. He should have explained to the defendant, everything you say to me is going to be confidential. And the second thing he should have done is sat down with the individual and try to identify, without any of the questions dealing with the offense, without any of the questions dealing with, you know, whether he'd done something wrong, but merely just a little bit of the background as to get a sense for whether this guy is just the kind that he can't. Tell you the truth, I've never seen a psychiatrist, Chief Justice. I've never seen a psychiatrist. And I'm 64. In 64, well, how long have I been an adult? Since knockout 18. And all those, I've never seen a psychiatrist or psychologist that couldn't come up with an opinion. Ever. So for this, other than a situation like this where the guy walks away, there would have had to have been some imposition of some kind of a sanction that never got entered. All that got entered was a theme in the first time the judge said.
Well, counsel, if the statute mandates it, and the statute mandates it, and the order mandated it, because isn't this information that the court should know?
Yes.
I mean, the court should know, shouldn't it, whether or not this unwillingness is connected to a disease, disorder, or defect, and whether or not the psychiatrist could or could not make that determination.
Yes.
Why? Why is that important for the court to know that?
Because the court's supposed to make a ruling on his competency, and anything that leads towards that fact is going to help the judge to make that ruling on competency.
Well, the statute says that the examiner shall include, if possible, an opinion about whether such unwillingness of the defendant was a result of mental disease. What evidence is there in the record to suggest that it was possible, given the circumstances here, to opine on that subject?
My memory, and I'll have to stretch it a little bit, CJ, my memory was the first letter was the much more expansive letter as to the efforts he took, and he talked to probation officers. I believe he talked to two probation officers, and he got information from both of those probation officers that neither of them wished to talk to my client. He also talked to one other head. He talked to an ACO who was in charge of the annex, too, where my client was kept, and apparently my client was kept in general population, and apparently my client was not a discipline problem and was not seen by a psychiatrist. I mean, I might have done 20 cases against the prison based on failure to provide medical attention, so not having a medical psychiatrist is not news to me. And the not talking to a probation officer, not talking to a social worker. Didn't talk to a social worker. Social worker out, you're supposed to be out to help the individual. Not talking to any of those kind of people is a clear indication that, that there was some evidence.
Well, if the court had this information that the examiner couldn't make a decision one way or the other,
had that answer,
then wouldn't the court then have to consider what options were available to it to make that determination? Because at that point, the court would be in a dilemma, right, as to whether or not it should proceed or not proceed.
And when you read Castro and Gianto, they talk about sort of that situation. They talk about that it's supposed to be.
So the, in effect, the court would need to know that information, because the court would have to decide on what options were available to it in order to determine that, absent the interview with the defendant.
Right, because it specifically says the judge must assess the opinion of the expert and add to that his observation of the defendant. So it's going to play a role in the judge's overall assessment of whether, in this particular case, this witness is competent to stand trial.
And you mentioned all these sources that would be potentially available if the court were to direct the examiner to try to determine whether or not unwillingness to participate was a part of mental disease disorder or defect, from other sources like the police report, the probation report.
He had the police report, by the way. He had that.
Or any other reports.
Right.
So if the examiner knew that that was his task, even the examiner would be able to help determine what sources would be relevant in terms of deciding that issue.
Yes, agreed. And for the reasons I've already stated, that any information you can give a judge, because in the end, 405 says the judge, the court, must make the decision, not the psychiatrist. And the judge is supposed to assess the think of this beyond, I mean, I couldn't think of a smaller case, to tell you the truth. A $5 fine, a petty misdemeanor marijuana case, to make the right law, to make the right call. The right call, the reasonable, prudent, rational result would be, you got to tell me why, you got to give me some basis, you got to tell me some understanding of why you can or cannot tell me whether you can, this guy's walking away from you was a result of his behavior. And there is a track. I mean, I have looked at so many prison institutional files. There's the sheet right on the inside that has every bit of discipline that's been imposed on an inmate. So this guy, there's a history on this guy that can be looked at, that wasn't looked at, that was just ignored. As I said, the ball dropped when it came to doing the one question that's required by law and by statute.
Mr. Schweiger, I just have one additional question.
Yes.
The relief you are requesting is a vacation of the conviction, a remand for determination of fitness. Is that correct?
No. We're looking for vacating of the opinion and a dismissal of the case.
All right. So your application stated you're requesting a remand, but at this...
Thank you for bringing that up. It's vacate the opinion, remand. Remand's on my mind. Vacate the opinion and dismiss the case. And I've had that happen in another misdemeanor.
How do you get
case.
To dismissal?
Dismissal?
How do you get to dismissal?
How do we get a dismissal? Because the case gets sent back down to the district court with instructions to dismiss.
On what legal basis would you
do that?
Base dismissal.
What legal basis would I base dismissal?
As opposed to simply sending it back down for a further examination, for example.
or with directions?
I don't have any.
Where is your client?
My client, you know, he sent a letter to you all. As you, if you haven't received a letter from my client by now, you would be one of the rare people. He sends letters to everybody, despite my strong admonition, please don't do that. He sent a letter to the court specifically asking to attend today's hearing. He's at OCCC, last I was told. He had moved from another facility to OCCC. And I got his letter. I'd already talked about him once I first got his letter asking to come to the court. And I called him immediately to say, because I saw the time running short, that we couldn't do it. And we agreed that we couldn't do it. And then a letter on Friday that asked the same thing. So he's not here because probably me. I couldn't see getting a motion on court into court, a ruling by the court on one today before 10 o'clock. As a matter of fact, thank you very
thank
much.
You, thank you, Mr.
Appreciate
Schweiger.
Being in front of you,
Mr. Vincent.
Please, the court, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Brian Vincent from the State of Hawaii. I think the first thing we need to do is look at 704-405, subsection 5. And that's included in the order which the examiner received. It's in paragraph 7 on page 4 of the order which the examiner received, in which he was supposed to conduct his examination by. And essentially, let me just read it for you. If the examination cannot be conducted by reason of the unwillingness of the defendant to participate therein, the report shall so state. Okay? The examiner did do that. Okay? And shall include, if possible, an opinion as to whether such unwillingness of the defendant was the result of a physical or mental disease, disorder or defect. The fact that if possible modifies shall include seems to indicate to me, and I think to a reasonable person, that they only need to include an opinion if it's possible.
So your position, state's position, is that the doctor does not have to state, pursuant to the statute, that it was not possible to reach an opinion.
That's correct. And furthermore,
how would the court know then that the examiner made the effort?
I think that they would have to trust that the examiner read that paragraph 7 on the report.
In the letter, is there any indication that the examiner said he made the effort but couldn't come to
there's
opinion?
There's no specific, didn't specifically address that issue, except just to say that he refused to.
The other part of the order asks that,
paragraph 5?
Yes, yeah. It says an opinion as to the capacity of the defendant to have the particular state of mind, which, there's a typo there, I guess, which is required to establish element of the offense charge. Two typos, the element of the offense charge. So there were two things. One, to determine fitness to proceed, and second, to determine the responsibility of the defendant at the time the crime was committed.
And the state of mind.
Well, it's part of the state of mind, right?
Yeah.
He's claiming, well, the court says, you know, he's not competent. Mm-hmm. But so did that order get fulfilled, that part of the order?
He specifically said he was not able to advise the court as to those three or two, if you want to characterize it, requirements.
So the defendant, when he first appears, or second time he appears, he says, I don't want to be represented by counsel, I want to represent myself. I don't want to be represented by the PD's office because they threatened to kill me.
Correct.
So, and at that point, Judge Devin says, okay, we want a mental exam. And then he goes through the first interview, then they come back to Judge Lee, and Judge Lee says, well, I think you have to go back and do this exam again. So he has two mental exams. They're all within, what, the offense, the first referral to the examiner, and the second referral to the examiner. They're all within basically 2 months, right?
That's correct.
So the question of whether this defendant, at the time he was arrested, was competent, that is, he had substantial capacity to know right from wrong and to conform his conduct to the requirements of law, that was never determined in this case, although the court made two referrals for that determination.
That's the penal responsibility, that's correct. It was never raised by the defendant himself. I guess it would be natural for him not to raise it if he was.
He never got to that issue because.
If he received, then he would never accept to raise that part of the case. But what I would like to say is, though, is that one thing, paragraph 7 and the statute 704-405 makes absolutely crystal clear, and that is that if it is possible for the examiner to form an opinion as to whether the refusal to participate is the result of a mental disease or disorder, the examiner shall include such an opinion in the report. And he didn't. So that indicates to me that it was not, there's only one other option, and that's that it was not possible.
So then what happens?
Then I think that you can't just keep on kicking this back to the examiner in hopes
that someday. Is the court supposed to proceed then at that point and just make a determination without input from the examiner?
Yes, that's the only option.
Is that what Janto and Castro say?
It says that it should be primarily based on the mental examination, but Castro and Janto don't believe address an issue where the person refused to cooperate with the examiner. And the reality is
the judge at that point would have had to consider options, correct, if he or she had that opinion? As if they felt that there was an opinion that the examiner couldn't give an opinion as to whether or not unwillingness was based on mental defect, then the judge would have had to weigh options, correct, at that point?
If there was not possible, that's correct.
One of the options possibly could have been to refer to another examiner?
It's always possible it could have been referred to another examiner. Maybe he would have reacted better to another doctor.
Because sometimes certain patients just don't relate well to certain doctors,
that's
right?
Correct. But I don't know, I don't know. The law doesn't require that you go to a different examiner the second time. And I don't think that the district court abused its discretion in this case. Send it back to the same.
Could the court?
Go ahead. No, I'm not suggesting that there was no use of discretion for referring back to the same doctor. But I'm just saying after a couple times, it's possible that it could have been another doctor or other options may have existed.
That is an option. Mm-hmm. And perhaps as a practical matter, it might be a good idea for.
Another option would be for the psychiatrist or psychologists to render an opinion based on all of the other records.
That's correct. And it appears from the report, both the reports, that he did avail himself of all the records that he thought that he could get hold of, that would bear on the defendant's fitness to proceed and penal responsibility.
Despite that, he never rendered an opinion with respect to fitness to proceed or penal responsibility. He said, I looked at this, this, and this, but I can't tell you whether he's fit to proceed or whether he was mentally responsible at the time of the crime.
Correct. You said that I'm not able to advise the court as to those two. It was just those. So, and it seems to me, when you read the bottom of the report, at the last paragraph, it should be noted, however, the defendant is currently housed in Annex 2 of the general population, not receiving any psychiatric care. To me, he's indicating that he just doesn't have enough data to base any opinion as to whether or not the refusal to cooperate indicates a mental disease or disorder.
Was it legitimate or illegitimate for the court to look at those kinds of factors then when it faces the defendant in court and tries to determine whether he or she is fit to proceed.
Well, I think that the court is not an abuse of discretion for them to and I think it's advisable for them to look at this report and to glean from it as much information regarding the question as possible. Even if it is with the defendant, I guess.
If I could interrupt you, Mr. Vincent, and maybe change the focus for just a moment, but it seems to me that the issue of fitness to proceed involves a pretty simple question. That would be, does the defendant understand the nature of the proceedings, and can he or she participate either pro se to adequately defend themselves or with the help of a lawyer? But if that's the case, when you look at the trial record, would you agree with me that the record of the proceedings seemed to show that the defendant did not appreciate what the charge was against him?
He believed that possession was not promoting. There was some confusion he had that the professor was not promoting. But I don't think that indicates mental illness. I think that many people, ordinary people who do not have mental illness, would confuse those issues. And I think that's a legal issue and not a mental health issue. And if you choose to represent yourself, you take on the risk that you have misunderstood the law.
Well, it seems to me the court, if my recollection is accurate, did explain the proposition that you just related, that possession was an included offense.
That's great.
Time and again to the defendant, and yet,
well, twice
when it came time, at least twice, but when it came time for closing argument, that seemed to be the basis of his closing argument. And then he had also the complaints of rashes and sores and wanted to be taken to the hospital. And it seems like, if that was not true, that would be further evidence of perhaps a mental problem. And if it was true, he might have had a...
Well, there's no indication in the record that his complaints about the rashes were not correct. He did say he went to see a skin specialist in Cairo and took care of the problem. From the record, when he said he was sick on the first occasion, from the record, the only indication of what I can find of what he meant when he said he was sick was that there was a report that he had a concussion, or he told the doctors he had a cut concussion, and the other one was that there was a complaint of skin problem during the middle of trial. So I don't know if when he says sick, I don't read that as to being I'm sick, mentally ill.
Mr. Vincent, aside from the fact that he kept saying, I'm innocent because I just possess, I didn't sell or promote, that occurred four times in the trial, right? Once when he was charged, once when he was cross-examining the police officer, another time in final argument, and then at sentencing, when the judge was ready to sentence him, he said, well, I didn't understand. I didn't know that I was being charged with possession.
Yeah.
So at least four times, yeah. Mm-hmm. Even though it's been explained to him four times.
Yeah, he says that, but I mean, that's not uncommon. I mean, even
he also said that the case should have been dismissed because the marijuana cigarette should have been suppressed because he was charged with two complaints, and the prosecution had dismissed one of them.
He didn't suggest that the evidence of the cigarette should be suppressed. I don't believe.
I
think he believed that the marijuana cigarette and the marijuana got out of the sock were the same thing. There should only be one count. And we ultimately dropped one count.
Right. Anyway, but that came out several times. It was explained to him, but he still kept saying, no, you can't use that. And you should be dismissed this charge because the marijuana under one of the counts had been dismissed, so they couldn't use the same evidence again.
Well, I would point out to you that he
I'm sorry. I just wanted confirmation from you that was what happened.
Yeah, he did. He did maintain his innocence all throughout, and I don't think that's unusual.
Mr. Vincent, does the state concede that, putting aside the issue of whether or not the doctor was required to give an opinion as to fitness, a refusal to cooperate, unwillingness to cooperate. The law does require the opinion as to the state of mind at the time of the incident. And that the opinion was not given. There was no opinion on that issue.
Yeah, and he did not give an opinion for the same reason.
So what would be the consequence of that?
Well, ultimately, the doctor's opinion on
it. Would you concede that that in and of itself would require at least a vacation and remand?
No, Your
or
Honor.
Or would that be a reversal at that point?
I think if you allowed a defendant who refuses to participate in a medical exam to use that as a reason why they could, they'd never be able to find any. I mean, I think defendants would figure that out pretty fast, and just would refuse to participate in a medical, in any psychiatric examination, and then you'd never be able to find that they were.
So you do not think that these professionals are equipped to render an opinion as to whether or not defendants may be acting or not acting, based not only on their interactions with them, but upon a review of all their records and interviewing people that have had interactions with these defendants?
I think it's highly useful for the court, and if the examiner opines on that, it should definitely be considered with great weight by the court. But if the medical professional is unable within his medical ethics to form an opinion, that shouldn't just stop the whole process whole.
Who
at some point, the layperson, the judge, has got to make his best guess.
Who determined that the defendant was mentally responsible at the time of the crime?
If I remember correctly, penal responsibility is an affirmative defense, the defendant never raised that at trial.
I'm sorry, the state doesn't have to prove intent beyond a reasonable doubt?
We have to prove intent, and...
A mens rea beyond a reasonable doubt?
That's correct, but
it's not an affirmative defense, correct?
The penal responsibility
I see.
Well, the defendant never raised it, and you can make the argument, as some courts have said, that if there's potential for a person to be mentally ill, you're not going to hold him to the requirements of someone who is not. But in this particular case, it was two judges who said, there's something wrong with this guy. And they said it within a month or 2 months of the time he was arrested. And when he first appears before them, he says, I want to represent myself. I don't want PDs representing me because they threatened to kill me. So it was the judges who said, we need a determination as to whether or not this person was mentally responsible at the time of the crime. So my question to you is, based on those orders by two judges, who made that determination so that they
that
could go forward? They could go
forward. Is fed or is penally responsible?
Penally responsible. Who made that determination?
Well, the penal responsibility wasn't as such addressed, okay? But as far as intent, the state can prove from circumstantial evidence what the intent of a person is. And in this case, Tierney clearly was possessing the marijuana. He was smoking it. He knew the nature of what marijuana was. Okay. Doesn't appear to be afraid of getting arrested for having marijuana, but that doesn't necessarily mean a mental disease or disorder. With respect to if the examiner found a mental disorder, Section 704.405 does not require to the court to blindly follow the examiner, although it should be given great weight. It's permissory. If the two parties agree on the reports from the examiner, it says that the court may base its recommendations on those reports. And if you look at Susan.
If the report comes back and says that he was not able to conform his conduct at the time, and the two parties agree, isn't the standard procedure to then refer him, to find him not guilty by lack of penal responsibility, and refer him for mental, psychological assistance instead of incarceration, as happened here?
Well, I think that the judge is, I would, maybe I back down from the position I made here earlier. The judge is presumed to follow the law, and the judge knows, in this case, that penal responsibility is a defense. So I think that penal responsibility, the fact that, I think that penal responsibility is implicit in the conviction here.
Unrepresented
even
attorney?
Though, even though Tierney did not raise it himself. So.
Mr. Vincent, isn't the only issue that Mr. Schweiger brought up on cert whether the court should have read out the, if possible, portion of Section 7 and that an opinion as to whether the petitioner's unwillingness was a result of physical or mental disease disorder defect should have been in the report? That's the only issue.
That's correct. That's correct. And I think
well, that's not the only issue, because the order that comes up sets out two requirements for the examiner. And the examiner said he couldn't make a determination as to those two issues. The reason he couldn't make a determination as to the penal responsibility part of the order was because he says he couldn't interview
but
the
I
defendant.
But I don't think you get to penal responsibility until.
Well, his whole premise in his report is, if I can't interview the defendant, I can't make a determination as to fitness to proceed or penal responsibility.
Once the defendant is found fit to proceed, he bears and chooses to proceed pro se, I believe he bears the burdens that any defendant would bear, and that one of those is to prove his affirmative defense of penal responsibility.
Well, here we have a case where the examiner didn't follow the two orders, and the court itself didn't enforce its own orders.
I would not characterize it that way.
Well, right. The court said, you find out, you give me an opinion as to his penal responsibility, and the examiner said, oh, I can't give you an opinion as there's penal responsibility. And the court never followed up on that.
Well, I don't think that it, once you find him, once you cannot find him fit to proceed, or once the examiner doesn't have a basis to find fitness to proceed or penal responsibility, I don't think you can't get, you can't get blood out of a rock.
So in this case, the whole idea of penal responsibility is subsumed under the problems with trying to determine whether it's fit to proceed.
That's correct.
The statute does say, however, it shall include if possible. It doesn't say may include if possible, correct?
It shall include
if possible
an opinion as to whether or not. And I think the common sense reading of that is that if it's not possible, you don't need to explicitly say that it's not possible. Under Sousa, even if he's found to have a mental disease or illness, that's not dispositive.
Sousa, you're citing the ICA opinion?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. I thought that was overruled.
That was overruled on other grounds, I believe. So I don't believe this particular, that was overruled on the grounds that, I believe Sousa said that it was a right and wrong decision, I guess. And later court cases said that it was an abuse of discretion. I think that's the grounds that was reversed on. Sousa said, I think that Sousa says, let me just read to you.
Did you include a table of contents in your answering brief?
I'm sorry. I didn't do the answering brief to the ICF, but I'm pretty sure she did. She did not? Table of contents or table of authority?
Well, table of contents, table of authorities, to see where you refer to Sousa. Please proceed. I'm sorry. It's fine. Please proceed.
Sousa says the decision as to defendants. Sousa says that. Yeah, it doesn't appear. I apologize for me. Sousa says the decision as to defendants' confidence to stand trial should not turn solely upon whether he or she suffers from a mental disease or defect, but must indeed with specific reference to the nature of the charge, the complexity of the case, and the gravity of the decisions with which he or she is faced. This is a very simple case. It involves possession of marijuana. It's relatively...
So you're arguing that 704, 404 should not apply to petty misdemeanors?
No, I'm not arguing that. I'm just saying that even if the court found that there was a mental disease, that Tierney had a mental disease or disorder, I think you need to look at the nature of the charge that they're charged with and the complexity of the facts and the seriousness of the consequences. And I think you would agree that this is a relatively minor case. It's not complex.
Constitutional facts. Implications should not be considered for minor cases.
I'm not arguing that. I'm just saying that with respect to defendant's ability to understand the proceedings in this case, I do not see why the court did not abuse its discretion in finding that the defendant Tierney in this case was fit enough to understand the consequences of the case, the kind of defenses he could interject. I would note that the defendant, he knew all the court dates he'd been in court. He knew who the judges were. He knew his future court dates, even though he had another felony case going on at the same time. He managed to coordinate those two court dates.
In the other case, he had standby counsel.
That's correct.
I'm
just reading the record. I don't know. Maybe he had a paper he was referring to. But he seems to be pretty clear about when he has to be in court or when he's going to be in court, who was there the last time he was there, what happened the last time he was there. He argues a speedy trial. He recognizes that it took us more than 180 days to get to trial. Okay. He didn't understand the fact that the medical examiner examination tolls that time, but he's relatively lucid, on the whole. So I would just, if you have any further questions. Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Vincent. Mr. Schweiger, your rebuttal?
I have nothing further.
Okay, any questions?
So I'm done. You seem to have it all.
Thank you very much to both of our attorneys here today for your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement.